KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, with the ethics case against Paul Wolfowitz of the World Bank coming to a decision soon, we thought we'd take a look not only at the specifics of that case in the hour ahead, we'll talk too about ethics in the workplace. That's with a panel and your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. An internal special committee has been investigating a controversy surrounding former Undersecretary of Defense and World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz. On his direction, the woman known as his companion, Shaha Riza, was given a large pay raise when she was reassigned from the World Bank to the Department of State in 2005. Paul Wolfowitz says he tried to recuse himself and took personal action only after the bank's ethics committee said he must. Bank officials say they were unaware of the generous terms of Ms. Riza's shift to the State Department. Mr. Wolfowitz is scheduled to testify today before the full 24-member board of the World Bank. Following his appearance, the bank will presumably decide whether or not to take the unprecedented action of firing a World Bank president. In this forum hour, we want to discuss the Wolfowitz case. Some wag said that, and it's amusing in some ways, that he didn't foresee the insurgency in Iraq and didn't foresee this insurgency. But we're also going to look at related issues of ethics in the workplace. And first, we're going to go to Washington and talk to Krishna Guha, who is Chief U.S. Economics Correspondent with the Financial Times. Joins us from the nation's capital. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Glad to have you here. Well, it has been a kind of insurgency there at the World Bank with employees and those saying that Wolfowitz should be ousted. What can we expect today?
It's still very hard to call. Look, this is a very, very fast-moving situation. The board has been meeting since late yesterday. It met again this morning. It adjourned just a short while ago at the U.S. request and is set to meet again this afternoon, Washington time. The U.S. is completely isolated, as far as we can tell, on the question as to whether Mr. Wolfowitz can remain in his job following the publication of this devastating report Monday, which found that he broke the bank's code of conduct, three separate staff rules, and the terms of his contract in his handling of a secondment package for Ms. Riza, the official with whom he had a romantic relationship.
So this is, then, is it not an ethical issue, plain and simple?
Now, Mr. Wolfowitz's supporters will tell you it's a terrible misunderstanding rather than an ethical lapse. The bank panel's report is really quite conclusive on this point. They say he broke the rules, he should have known better. The nub of the question is this. When Mr. Wolfowitz went to the World Bank, his girlfriend was already working there. There was a bank rule that said no employee could work under the authority of another staff member who they had a romantic relationship with. This meant basically she needed to be seconded or take a financial settlement and leave or be reassigned to one of a handful of independent agencies that Wolfowitz didn't have ultimate control over. The board's ethics committee recommended that she should be reassigned in this way and given compensation in the form of a single promotion. Wolfowitz went away and directed the bank's human resources chief to give her all the benefits the ethics committee had recommended and a lot else to boot, a pay rise in excess of the maximum that would normally go with that promotion, 8% per annum guaranteed raises thereafter, and a more or less presumed promotions to follow on her way back into the bank when he left. So he's got himself into a lot of trouble over this issue.
And the assumption is he should have recused himself from the beginning, from the get-go.
That's right. Look, what people are saying is there are two reasonable things he could have done. First of all, he could have implemented the exact advice he was given by the board's ethics committee. Alternatively, he could have delegated to somebody else the decision to negotiate what might be reasonable in addition to what he'd been told to do. But he didn't do either of this. He got personally involved in dictating the terms and conditions, and which, in the board's eye, is far worse than this. He told the head of human resources that he could not consult the World Bank's top lawyer to see whether what they were doing was reasonable or not.
And I'm inferring from what you say, because I think you used the word devastating with respect to this report, that this does not look good for Mr. Wolfowitz.
It doesn't look good for him at all at the moment. Look, the administration has been deeply reluctant to let him go, and we can't rule out at this 11th hour that people in the White House are still saying, no, we fight on, we fight on. But I get the sense that reality is slowly dawning within the administration that this is a lost cause.
Krishna Guha, again, is Chief U.S. Economics Correspondent with Financial Times and joined us this morning from Washington. We thank you so much, Mr. Guha.
My great pleasure.
And let me tell you who is joining us for the rest of the hour as we not only probe the case of Paul Wolfowitz's conduct, but talk about workplace ethics. We want to welcome Kirk Hansen, who is Professor and Executive Director of the Makula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, previously professor in business ethics at Stanford's Graduate School of Business for 23 years. He's in Santa Clara this morning, joining us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Adam Galinsky, who is an associate professor of management and organizations at the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern, and he's joining us from Evanston, Illinois. Welcome, Adam Galinsky.
Thanks so much.
And we have with us in studio Susan Springborg, who is president of Springborg & Associates, LLC. They're a diversity consulting firm. Welcome, Susan Springborg.
Thank you.
Kirk Hansen, let me begin with you. This is another one of those kind of dual career relationship questions. But what do we learn from this in terms of just the whole arena of ethics and the whole realm of ethics?
I think there are several lessons to be drawn from this, even before we understand and know what happens to Paul Wolfowitz. Clearly, there was insensitivity on his part and on his partner's part. I think it's inevitable that when you have two partners who work in the same organization or who come to work there because perhaps somebody becomes CEO, as Wolfowitz did, there's a price to be paid. And I don't think Wolfowitz or his partner wanted to pay a price for this. They wanted to have some guarantees that they were going to be made whole, that her career would not suffer. While we're sympathetic with the woman, I think there is a real danger that we don't think there should ever be a price to pay in society. And yeah, it's hard for those of us in the real world who've paid a price when our partner moves to another city, or we have to be the tag along, not to understand that there is a price to be paid.
Well, there's some confusion, though, on what this ethics committee wanted Wolfowitz to do. The ethics committee actually investigated him, and gave him a clean bill of health over 9 months ago.
Well, that is one of the points that's conflicted. In the report, the argument is that isn't really the report that was released Monday. That isn't really what the ethics committee said. It just said there's no reason to reopen this issue. But they would argue they never looked at the specific terms, and they were never aware that Wolfowitz had been so deeply involved in dictating the terms. And it's on that basis that they have said that he violated World Bank policy.
How much of this, and we'll hear what Adam Galinsky has to say about this as well, but how much of this has to do with what one of my friends calls the SOB factor, that is, that people don't like Wolfowitz, that Wolfowitz has created a great deal of enmity because he was one of the architects of the Iraq War and so forth?
Well, I think there's no question that in American the American workplace today, there's just a raft of ethics questions about conflict of interest because of an entirely new environment with women going to work in such large numbers, with the recognition of gay relationships, with many more conflicts arising because of romantic partners both working in the same environment. And we have to be sensitive to the conflicts of interest. We have to have different ways of resolving those. But at the same time, this is one more example of if you've got the SOB that people are very critical of, they're looking for a reason to bring them down.
Again, Kirk Hansen is professor and executive director of the Makula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. Adam Galinsky is associate professor of management and organizations at Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern. And Professor Galinsky, there is a sense here that Paul Wolfowitz may be one of those people who is unable to see how people see him. And there's a kind of maybe ethical blindness on that sense that doesn't exactly help his cause?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the most interesting aspects of a range of different research that's coming out is how people who are at the I guess, the nexus or the watershed of conflicts of interest are incapable of fully appreciating how those conflicts will affect their judgment, affect their decisions. And so people in general are very, very poor at determining when their own behavior, their own judgments, their own actions will comprise a conflict of interest. But I think what's particularly important in Paul Wolfowitz's case is that my own research with Deb Grunfeld at Stanford and Joe McGee at NYU and Ina Nessie at Stanford shows that people who are in positions of power are particularly incapable or insensitive to recognizing how their own behavior may conflict with a variety of different sort of moral standards or may come into conflict with a variety of other perspectives.
So a lot of what may be attributable to what may indeed turn out to be the fall of Paul Wolfowitz has to do perhaps with that old Greek thing of hubris?
A little bit of hubris, a little bit, you know, and also I think falls back on the famous phrase that, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the idea that is when people don't feel sort of checked in their power, they don't feel the need or the psychological tendency to sort of consider a variety of different perspectives, and that blindness really leads them sort of down alleys that may trap them in the future.
But I'm reminded here of the fact that many doctors who act cordially toward their patients and show a proper respect for their patients don't get sued for malpractice as opposed to those who seem to exhibit some form of arrogance or lack of sensitivity to other people. And I'm wondering how much that has to do with the whole ethical realm. That is there more of a likelihood that someone can be toppled or their power can be dismantled because simply people don't like them?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a variety of different ways that psychology and social psychologists demonstrate that sort of people's reputation or how we see them serves as a filter for how we evaluate their behavior. So take the sort of example of you see someone sort of, you know, push someone. If you like the person, you'll say that push was playful. If you don't like them, you'll see that it was an aggressive shove. And so the exact same behavior performed by two different people with different reputations and different, you know, whether it's animosity or sort of friendship will be interpreted dramatically differently.
Some of the studies you've done on ethics, and you were involved in that famous E on the forehead study, I believe, weren't you?
Yes, that was with the colleagues that I just mentioned, Deb, Joe, and Ina. And so what we did in that study is we just put people into positions of power, high and low power in the laboratory, and we asked them a very simple question. We just said, draw an E on your forehead. And what we found is that people who were in the positions of power were three times more likely to draw an E on their forehead in a self-oriented direction, whereas people in the low power position were much more likely to draw E, taking into account sort of other people's visual perspectives. And we use that data sort of, and a variety of other experiments that we've conducted suggest that simply the experience, the possession of power, leads people to focus on their own egocentric desires and leads them away from the perspectives, from the viewpoints, and from the considerations of others.
If power is not abused, and if there is a sense of just general cordiality, but aside from that, linking ethics to action within a company, I think it's your belief, is it not, that the company is more apt to have success?
Absolutely. I've created a course here at Northwestern with my colleagues David Austin Smith and Tim Fetterson called Values-Based Leadership. And a lot of what we talk about in this course and some of the research we're starting to develop suggests is that when organizations explain decisions that they make in terms of the values and in terms of their code of conduct, they're much more likely to be effective and the organization is much more likely to sort of be led, I guess, or steered in the proper direction.
Adam Glinsky, again, is Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern and is with us this morning from Evanston, Illinois. Here with us in studio is Susan Springborg, President of Springborg & Associates, LLC. They're a diversity consulting firm and work largely with law firms. I guess what you discover in this high-pressure world of billing and the world of corporate law particularly is that time presents an ethical problem, just the pressure of time.
Absolutely. I think people are much less likely to be thoughtful about how they treat others in that kind of situation. Under stress, I think most of us revert to some behaviors that we probably don't like to see in ourselves and other times. And I see a real increase in the kind of behavior that creates difficulties interpersonally in the workplace under this kind of stress. I also want to underscore the SOB factor. I have seen countless examples over the years I've done work with firms of people who the committed the same kind of inappropriate behavior or borderline behavior, often having to do with sexual harassment, for example, or other kinds of insensitivities related to gender or race. And in the case of a person who is well-liked, often that behavior is tolerated and somebody will say, well, it's just kind of his style or it's fine. He's really an okay person. I know he doesn't mean it. And in the case of somebody who is arrogant and unpleasant, they're much more likely to use that as the final way to get a hold of this person.
Chris, in many instances, it's hard to determine. There's a kind of grayness often about this ethical behavior, especially when we're talking about specific interest groups feeling that they're being mistreated or they're not given the kind of perks or even just equity that they deserve.
Right. Now, I think a lot of the ethical issues that I see are very cloudy. I see it a lot in the assumption, for example, most of my clients see their firms or their companies as meritocracies, that we really judge people on the basis of their merit. We're fair in judging them, and usually it's people who have power who are in the position of judging them, and we're uncontaminated by bias. If you look, however, at studies, for example, at Harvard's Implicit Association test that was developed 10 years ago and looks at the unconscious bias, it is, of course, very unlikely that anybody's going to leave their unconscious biases at the door when they come to work to make the decisions and judgments about people. So the kinds of ethical dilemmas that I see are really much more gray area kind of behavior where people make judgments about, for example, whether a person of color has been hired under lowered standards, and therefore when that person makes the first mistake, they're written off, as opposed to people who aren't seen that way. Or whether a woman is seen as not committed because she may have children, or whether somebody who is gay is seen as somebody who probably isn't going to fit in, whatever that means, to this culture. So it becomes much more subtle.
These unconscious biases, though, can often be not necessarily, particularly to the person who has them, unconscious biases at all. In fact, in many instances, they defend against the notion that they're being biased, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. And they think that they're fair and they will justify it in a variety of ways. And of course, you know, many women do have children and some women do leave the workplace. So, I mean, they will depend on those kinds of defenses. But I think the difficulty, of course, is in the generalizations. And, you know, and I believe that those kinds of judgments really do play a part in who succeeds and who doesn't succeed in the workplace.
Susan Springborg, again, is president of Springborg & Associates, and Kirk Hansen is executive director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics. This kind of pressure that we're seeing these days for inclusion and for diversity and all of that, Kirk, really does present ethical dilemmas, it seems to me, because different people have entirely different, almost with quantum difference, notions about what is and is not appropriate and ethical here.
I think that's true. I think we've illustrated in the discussion already some of the core lessons from dealing with ethics in organizations over the last 20 or 30 years. That's the horizon over which companies have thought explicitly about ethics. And I think one of those lessons is that there's some unavoidable ethical dilemmas, and the dilemmas involved with relationships in the workplace are amongst the thorniest. I think the second is that people's perceptions are different, and I think Susan's emphasis on that is really important, that people will look at the same case and perceive it quite differently. But as you say, there are some ways people actually have different ethical values, and I think corporations are in the difficult situation of having to broker some of those differences. It becomes worse in global corporations where you have multiple cultural contexts and the values coming out of those, but companies have to take a stand. And I think if there's one thing we've learned about managing corporate ethics is that the corporation has to communicate a consistent message about its standards, and then its top executives have to be the most important models of that. I think that's what's so troubling in the Wolfowitz case, and the report released Monday mentions that two or three times, that his example is really destructive to the ethical culture within the organization.
Adam Galinsky, there's some interesting examples that have called from things that you've said. And in fact, I remember reading about some toll takers in New Jersey who had been stealing some money. And there was a fail-safe system that was instituted, and it proved to be detrimental to their work habits. Once they weren't stealing these trifling amounts of money, they weren't working as well. There's that whole strange notion. In fact, in Israel, you talked about a fine for picking up kids late from daycare, and there was less likelihood that people would, in fact, pick their kids up on time once that fine was instituted, or giving money for blood donors proved that the number of blood donors went down. All of these things are kind of strange variables.
Well, I think one of the things to think about is you have to think about, well, what regulates people behavior. And economists all of a sudden focus on incentives. They say, okay, change the incentive systems that people under, provide more rewards or more punishments if you want to promote or prevent certain types of behavior. And that changes people's sort of calculus on what behavior is acceptable or unacceptable. But what a lot of research demonstrates is the idea that what regulates a lot of people's behavior are a variety of different emotional factors. Some of them might be things that we would call guilt or empathy or anger or a variety of things that aren't directly attributable or decomposed into incentive system structures. So just to give you the quick example of the Israeli daycare is they decided to do an experiment. They said in some of the daycares in Israel, we'll institute a fine. This is some research conducted by Yuri Ganizi at University of San Diego. And they looked at, well, how many people were late before the fines were introduced, how many people were late after the fines were introduced, and what they also looked at to some control groups in which no fines were introduced. And what they found is that when late fees were instituted, and these were small fees, not big fees, like the equivalent of 1 hour of babysitting, more people were late, and they were even more late when they picked up their kids, because what you had done is you had transformed the situation from an ethical consideration or motivated by feelings of guilt, and when you instituted the incentive system, you obliterated that normal regulator of behavior called guilt, and now people are simply making a cost-benefit calculus. Okay, well, it's better for my time to do this, and I'll just pay the late fee. And what was particularly pernicious in this circumstance was as when they removed the late fees, lateness still continued because once you obliterated guilt, it didn't reemerge. And as my colleague Dave Messick would often say, he says that, you know, any type of sanction system that ever gets introduced, they are tragically ineffective if there's A, a low probability of detection, and B, if the punishment or fine is low.
That's fascinating.
you obliterate all the emotions, and all you have is people making cost-benefit calculus.
Yeah. I want to go back to you, Susan Springborg, just a quick sense about, you know, when there are hostile remarks or what are perceived as hostile remarks in the workplace, jokes about people's ethnicity or sexuality or gender. These can be thoughtless. They can be politically incorrect. They can be, in fact, punishable. But there's a kind of double standard. I mean, the pervasiveness in the culture is that these things are allowed. They're out there. They're ubiquitous.
Right.
So that's a kind of ethical double standard,
doesn't it? I think it's confusing to people. For example, they can watch television and they can see all of these jokes and everybody's laughing, and then they go to the workplace and they're told that this behavior isn't okay. It's, for example, it's the same about sexuality. It's okay in the on television and in films that sexuality is fairly blatant, but you have to be very careful in the workplace and in most places about what kinds of comments you make and your behavior.
It's a real ethical dilemma for many
people. I think it is, and I think it's very confusing for people. Incidentally, I think that I notice far more comments having to do with sexual orientation than I do about race or gender. I work all over the country, and I notice that that is the one holdout place where political correctness in many places just has not had a lot of effect.
Well, let me take the opportunity to bring our listeners into this discussion. We're talking not only about the World Bank probe of Paul Wolfowitz's conduct, but talking about workplace ethics in general, and you are welcome to join us with your thoughts or reflections or questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available, and we welcome your calls. Again, it's 866-733-6786, or send an email to us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the World Bank probe of Paul Wolfowitz's conduct and also examining workplace ethics today. And we spoke at the top of the hour with Krishna Guha, who is Chief U.S. Economics Correspondent with the Financial Times. And with us for the hour is Kirk Hansen, Professor and Executive Director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. And he taught business ethics at Stanford for almost a quarter of a century. Adam Glinsky will be with us most of this hour. He's Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern. And Susan Springborg is here with us in studio. She's President of the Springborg and Associates, LLC, excuse me, diversity consulting firm. I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment. And again, you can join us toll free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, at our toll free number, 866-733-6786, or send an email to us. And our email address is forum@kqed.org. About the Wolfowitz case specifically, Kirk Hansen, here's a listener named Tom who says, according to the LA Times, Wolfowitz came to the World Bank with an agenda: redirect its actions from meaningful development aid. The existing staff was appalled and had been lying in wait to get him since day one. This not workplace, workplace ethics should be the story. What was the policy direction Wolfowitz implemented? What was the former direction? And then he goes on to say KQED is a fine station, but sometimes leans toward the tabloid. And I have no idea what that means. I plead not guilty to that, as most of my colleagues here would. But what about the real – is there a real case underlying this?
I think there's a real case underlying this in terms of how he has modeled or not modeled ethical behavior within the organization. And the question of conflict of interest over his partner is a real issue. That doesn't deny what we referred to earlier as the SOB factor, that people may have been lying in wait. One of the other ethics issues is that Wolfowitz has been a very articulate advocate for controlling corruption around the world and for making the World Bank a much stronger force for the elimination of corruption in developing countries. And one of the costs, if he is indeed forced out today, will be somewhat that emphasis that he's made one of his signature initiatives.
Well, David Brooks of the New York Times did an column on this, and essentially it was in praise of Wolfowitz, and I just wanted to mention it because what he says is that, and it's a defense of Wolfowitz, but what he says is this is a strong-minded guy. He's an ideologue. There are many people who disagree with him, and so that could be a problem as well, or certainly part of the whole picture. You think, Kirk?
Well, but that doesn't mean that we can't be concerned about the ethical issues. I'm just thinking of Boeing a year ago, where a new CEO was brought in on the heels of a CEO having to resign because of romantic entanglements. And the new CEO then got involved in a romantic relationship with one of the vice presidents of the organization. And you say, how could this individual possibly think he could get away with that? He was important for the restoration of the company, but nonetheless he had to go. And I think, unfortunately, in this case, the ethical misdeeds of Wolfowitz in this case, at least in my judgment, probably mean he has to go, that he can't be the values-oriented leader of the World Bank that he sought to be.
We're going to take your calls, and we begin with Reza. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a couple quick comments. The first one is, to some extent you've alluded to it, but the SOB factor in this case is very much earned. This is a person that, through his own actions, in my opinion, definitely deserves that title, and there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg. I don't think the fact that he's an SOB should give him a free pass. And secondly, I think to some extent he's also guilty by association, having been a political appointee, potentially, having, from my understanding, had no banking experience in the past, and he was appointed for his ideology, and it's a little bit of a case of a heck of a brownie going on here, in my opinion, and I'll take the comments.
Well, we thank you for your opinion, and Adam Galinsky, certainly his being an American with the kind of low popularity that Americans unfortunately have now in the world doesn't help his situation.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, one of the things that, when you think about people's attitudes, right, is that, and their decisions on what is or is not ethical, we talked about sort of the SOB factor of Paul Wolfowitz in particular, but there's also the SOB factor of America more generally in the United States. And in a great study done by some people at Columbia University, they showed that people who were members of the United Nations, the more their country had negative attitudes towards America, the more likely they would have unpaid parking tickets. So this idea that we are sort of motivated in our behaviors by our attitudes towards important people and important groups.
It's also probably instructive for a moment, Susan Springboard, to consider the odd case of Bill Clinton, in that this is a man who, unlike, say, Packwood and others, had endeared himself to many women through charm and through feminist positions that he took and so forth. So there seemed to be a different ethical standard there, too.
Well,
I'm talking about sexual harassment in the workplace. For example, somebody comes across and is a boss and seems kind and disposed toward advancing women and the glass ceiling is not a problem and so forth, maybe less likely to get into hot water.
But
even
not impossible for him to get into hot water.
No,
absolutely.
I'm not suggesting that at all.
No, not impossible at all. But interestingly, I think certainly Clinton has been... his reputation has been rejuvenated, shall we say, in the last years, and I think that his indiscretions have largely faded for most people, and particularly, I think, for women.
I'm going to read some of your emails. By the way, you can send us an email, forum@kqed.org. Join us by phone, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Here's Ben from Berkeley, who says, as a San Francisco liberal, I, like many of your listeners, found Mr. Wolfowitz's actions within the Bush administration regrettable at best. However, everything I've read about his tenure at the World Bank has looked pretty good. He's made documentable progress, given increased voice to the third world recipients of aid, and paid long-deserved attention to the needs and vices of sub-Saharan Africa and its leaders. To oust Mr. Wolfowitz over a relatively minor issue seems foolhardy. He does a hard job well, and it seems that the public intense public scrutiny of his actions has already ensured that he will not make the same mistake again. We'll let that opinion stand, and we'll read some more of your opinions. Here, John says, there is a real pattern of arrogance in the behavior of Bush appointees to posts like the World Bank and UNESCO. Prime example being Peter Smith, another loyal Republican and Bush appointee who left CSU Monterey for a senior position in UNESCO. He left abruptly after a consulting scandal where he violated UNESCO's contracting rules, giving a major project to a firm that had no experience in educational matters. He was also one of the people with the CSU golden handshake drawing the full pay for a year, and he left the CSU job. These folks all seem to think that the purity of their ideology permits them to take whatever they need. It should be stopped. And another listener from Palo Alto says, Wolfowitz is not just any SOB corrupted by power or victimized by people who don't like him. He comes out of a culture, the Bush administration, that specifically nurtures nepotism and the personal exercise of power without oversight and with impunity. Wolfowitz was given his World Bank position by George Bush despite his lack of experience in the field, which he is now using as part of his defense, a corrupt situation from the get-go. Well, what do you think, Kirk Hansen, about all these attempts to link Wolfowitz to a kind of Bush zeitgeist?
Well, I think it's unfair at this point to try to pull Wolfowitz out based on his past performance in the Bush administration. I think the relevant thing is the first of the letters you read said is, how has he done at the World Bank? And I think that's the relevant question today. We may not like his role in the Iraq War, but he's in a different role today, and I think that's the proper standard. The provocative question in those emails is, if he's a good performer in his job other than, say, a minor case of plagiarism or a minor case of harassment or this particular situation of involving himself in the pay for his partner, should he get a pass? Is that not serious enough from an ethical standpoint that we ought to slap him on the hand and let him continue?
You know, it's a great example of that that's right in the news now is the guy who heads up HBO. You familiar with that case?
I have read about it. I don't know the details.
Well, he was had to resign under pressure for what sounded like abuse to a woman employee who worked under him, so to speak. And the fact of the matter is he had another episode like that a number of years ago. But there are people in the company who are, you know, in mourning and bereft. They say he's the visionary. He's the heart and soul of the company. Mm-hmm. You know, they're losing the Sopranos and they're losing him, too. But he's the bigger loss.
Well, it's interesting when that argument is made. As often as not, when you do more research, you find a pattern of behavior. There was a well-known case here in the South Bay where a superintendent of schools in San Jose was hailed as a great visionary leader, was forced out because he had falsified his resume, and everybody said it was a tragic case. He should have been allowed to continue. But then on further research, they found a whole pattern of deceptive and dishonest behavior behind it. So I'm always skeptical about the argument that this person just stumbled once or this is a momentary failing. I think, unfortunately, you have to look at patterns of behavior, and these particular incidents we see don't happen in isolation.
And Mike, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, how do we make the distinction between, on this SOB factor, distinguish between what we see the person as, namely, we think they're a jerk, and so they look like a jerk, and what they see themselves as, like, were their comments or actions motivated from a, you know, sort of a spirit of meanness, or did they mean well and we just misinterpreted? So how does just comments on how that plays out?
Well, that's right in your bailiwick, Kirk Hansen, isn't it?
Well, I think that's one of the perception problems that we were discussing. As Adam said, we can look at the same thing, same behavior, and interpret it two completely different ways. It certainly is an issue which arises in harassment cases and diversity cases. Maybe Susan has some experience.
Yeah, I want to hear from Susan on this and Adam both. Susan Spinberg?
Well, my experience in dealing with people who are sort of chronically abusive in how they treat others is usually, and I often do coaching of people who have been identified as such. And usually they have the same pattern of explanation, which is, I have very high standards. I'm very demanding. I know that. But I'm a perfectionist and I'm a very high achiever. And other people simply do not perform at the level I expect them to. And I recognize I sometimes get impatient and I probably shouldn't do that. But actually what I need are people who can perform. And there just aren't very many of those in this
organization. I demand of myself this perfectionism. Absolutely. So I demand it of others. That's
absolutely.
Always the explanation.
Absolutely. And the people who are complaining are the people who really aren't up to snuff here. And so it's a very closed system that they have. And although they don't, you know, they acknowledge that sometimes they might be a little difficult or they might occasionally yell at somebody, that really it's essentially justified.
Adam Galinsky.
Yes. I think, you know, one of the most interesting capacities that we have as humans is the ability to compartmentalize different aspects of our lives into different forms of behavior, right? So you can imagine the person HBO who people would see as a visionary, maybe ethics in all aspects, but except for this maybe this one aspect. And so that individuals like Paul Wolfowitz are really capable, or all individuals are capable of saying, you know, of acting, seeing themselves as ethical and either minimizing their unethical behaviors by giving them different explanations or putting them into a different compartment. And I think that one of the most interesting things about the Paul Wolfowitz case is what Kirk brought up, which is this idea of hypocrisy. And I think that one of the things that we forget about is that people are very, very upset by the perception that someone is engaged in a hypocritical fashion. And so Paul Wolfowitz made as his value statement, right, the elimination of corruption, and then he himself acted in a way that violated that sort of standards of corruption. And I think that where people are most upset is when people act in a hypocritical way, yet we are blind to our own hypocrisy. And I think that is one of the tragedies of Wolfowitz, is that what he wanted to do led to his downfall.
Well, as I said, the Greeks used to call it hubris, didn't they?
Yeah.
Let me thank Mike for his call, and we'll go on to more. Diane, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One of the things that I found absolutely fascinating in this discussion is I spend a lot of time volunteering in the elementary schools, and I also have a middle school student, and many of the things that you're discussing I see taking place with the kids. Everything from the SOB factor, where two kids, same behavior, one child is, you know, the likable, everybody loves him, and oh, isn't he so funny, and another kid who isn't, and it's like, and that's the kid who's getting sent to the principal's office for basically the same type of behavior. And I was absolutely fascinated by the discussion of the removal of guilt, and how that sense of guilt, once it disappears, it kind of removes restraints on considerate behavior, and that it never comes back. And I was interested in any comments that your guests might have about these behaviors showing up in children, and that's, you know, that it isn't just something that's an adult behavior.
Well, let me go against Adam Galinsky on this, because Adam, I think wasn't there a study that awarded people for staying late in the workplace, and it proved that they were less apt to? In other words, pride was more the motivator than a monetary award. Now, you could apply that to children. Often children get, you know, gold stars, and they get patted on the head, and they get these incentives and so forth. But pride is really much more of a motivator, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, so there's a variety of different sort of factors that matter in people. So if you take the sort of blood donation idea that when people were paid to donate blood, the number of donors went down, because before they were motivated by empathy and sort of altruistic tendencies, the payment obliterated that, and now they're making cost-benefit calculations. The same thing with staying late, right? You're invested in the company, and now when it's a payment, well, now you're making different types of calculation. Kids often have intrinsic motivation in tasks. If you reward them with material resources for participation, participating in those tasks, their interest in those tasks go down. So one of the things that David Austin Smith and Tim Fetters and I talk a lot about is, as values-based leaders, to think about, well, what really regulates people's behavior? And this could be kids, and this could be CEOs. And what you want to understand is that anytime we try to introduce an incentive system, we may be obliterating these other aspects that, more appropriately or more effectively regulate people's behavior.
Again, Adam Glinsky is Associate Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Business. We thank the caller. We'll go over more calls in just a moment. I want to ask you, though, Kirk Hansen, about, well, the somewhat unusual and very revelatory case of Lord John Brown, former chair of British Petroleum.
I mean,
it certainly bears some scrutiny here.
It does. It's a, in some ways, it's a tragic case. In some ways, it bears a lot of resemblance to the Wolfowitz case. Lord John Brown has been CEO of British Petroleum, which owns ARCO, bought ARCO here in California a few years ago, and he was a very successful CEO. He had come under some criticism for maintenance practices in the North Slope of Alaska and such, and was scheduled to retire this year. He was asked in court about his relationship with a particular individual, a man that had been his partner. Lord John Brown had never come out of the closet as a gay man and had compartmentalized his life. In order to continue that, he lied in court, and that led to his immediate resignation as CEO of BP. But, you know, some people have argued that we ought to be sympathetic with Lord John Brown because he became CEO 15, 20 years ago when it was much tougher to be a very senior executive and be gay, and that we ought to understand the context and the pressures that he faced.
What do you think it is, Susan Springborg, that you've discovered more than gender, more than race, more than ethnicity? There's homophobia and mistreatment. Does that simply reveal, in many cases, I would think, greater lack of sensitivity, maybe, as opposed to what one would consider breaches of ethics?
Yeah, I think greater insensitivity. I think also it's the only area of diversity that I find people feel that they have justifiably negative feelings about. They cite their religious beliefs and so forth, and they're unable often to distinguish between their own personal belief system, which I, as a diversity consultant, am not here to challenge, but to separate that from fair treatment in the workplace. And it's very difficult for them to make a separation between the two of those. And I want to say I'm very sympathetic also to the situation of somebody who chose not to come out coming into the workplace 20 years ago. I see a great difference between the number of people who are out who are older GLBT attorneys, for example, and younger people. And there is a real difference.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to say goodbye to Adam Glinsky. Professor Glinsky, thank you so much for joining us this hour on Forum.
My pleasure.
Appreciate your having been with us. Adam Glinsky, again, is Associate Professor of Management and Organizations with the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern. And he joined us from Evanston, Illinois. And joining us from Lewistown, Pennsylvania, is Mike. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing today?
Hi.
Hey, comment and question. First of all, do you find that when you counsel folks that they have more baggage than just, say, a personality to, and a will to dominate others? And then secondly, well, I forgot my second part, so I'll just leave it at that, and I apologize.
Okay. Susan Springberg, can we go to you on this?
Well, I certainly think we all have a lot of baggage and, you know, attitudes that people may have about, for example, people who are different from them can be, you know, part of the other things that they're carrying into the workplace besides simply being a perhaps more abusive personality or type A personality. So, yes, I think absolutely there are other factors that can contribute.
Hermione reminded me, Mike, your second question was about role models.
Well, yeah, it was about role models. I apologize. I know in my own business and in my own life I've used past great Americans as role models, George Washington being the primary one. I'm wondering if you ever find that to be an effective tool.
An effective tool, you mean in inculcating ethics, right?
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yeah, well, it helps with kids, you know, do not tell a lie and cherry tree story that never happened and all that, or Abe Lincoln walking miles to give somebody a penny back or so forth. But what about this just in terms of the workplace? And Kirk Hansen, I guess we can say safely that ethics filters down from the top usually in terms of role models, doesn't it?
There's a lot of discussion the last few years about tone at the top, and there's no more powerful influence of tone at the top than stories about the CEO or stories about the founders. In Hewlett-Packard, clearly the stories about Bill and Dave have a very special power within the organization and really across the valley, not just in HP itself. And similarly, stories about how the CEO handled things set the tone for the organization. It's the single most powerful communicator of the real values of an organization is what the CEO does and what is said about her behavior or his behavior.
But also middle management and whoever you have to report to, your superior, yeah?
Definitely. This rolls downhill. You can have an exemplary CEO and a resistant and deviant middle manager, and within the middle manager's organization, you can have a whole group of people who engage in questionable behavior. The challenge for corporations is how to reach around that middle manager who's not on board and get the people that work for her or work for him to resist that kind of pattern, or to report the middle manager to more senior management and say that this person is misbehaving.
Again, Kirk Hansen is professor and executive director of the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. And as you know, we're holding our pledge drive now, so we are obliged to step aside for a few minutes from our broadcast audience. Those of you listening to us on Sirius Satellite Radio System will remain with the program. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio, and I'm Michael Krasny. Sorry, Susan Springborg, you were going to say something.
I was going to say that I'm struck in my work by the number of managers from middle management on up who don't really recognize how carefully their behavior is scrutinized. They don't get it. They don't understand that people are watching them very closely. They're taking their cues from them. Whether or not a given issue is important in an organization is something that the behavior of a CEO has an enormous amount to say about and impact on. But very often they don't recognize that.
And on we go to more calls. Mark, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Surely.
I just wanted to point out that, you know, these ethical lapses can have, you know, more fundamental causes. I mean, just the whole concept of manifest destiny, society's dependence on technology, you know, it's just led to a loss of personal responsibility, not only to care for the environment and the planet, much less each other. And so, I don't want to lose sight of that, that there are some major issues here facing society as a whole that we are just bred into. But I want to take it back to the a comment earlier about, you know, the failure of regulation, based on, you know, low fines or the ability to conduct inappropriate behavior undercover. And I think that this points to kind of the carrot and stick approach. Unfortunately, in our current regulatory environment, our major natural resource agencies have been systematically underfunded and demoralized through the lack of funding so that they can't even do their jobs to regulate not only environmental harms, but now we're having to look to voluntary compliance, and I'm hoping that that works, but I think you have to have both.
So you're saying, really, that there's lack of oversight that's pervasive, and Kirk Hansen agreed?
I think there is a problem with designing good oversight. There's a real reason we've emphasized the concept of accountability over the last few years, and I would agree with the caller that's one of the dangers, is that we have lost our sense of personal accountability. I think there, as he was also pointing out, there are some influences in the environment, whether it's the general impersonalization of life in this country, or whether it's the crudeness of behavior on TV and in the rest of life that carries over into the workplace. There are some broader influences. There's also a cultural sense of, hey, I ought to be looking out for number one and not necessarily for others, and that somehow I'm a fool if I engage engage in more concern for others. And I think those are damaging to each of us when we go to make the choices we make day to day.
On the other hand, one hears the argument that Sarbanes-Oxley has provided more of a likelihood of monitoring or overseeing ethical questions, and that there's been more whistleblowing that's been efficacious, and that has been encouraging others to be whistleblowers.
Yes. I think there's no question that Sarbanes-Oxley has had a positive effect. The business community has often complained about the cost of compliance, but there's clearly been a positive impact of creating an awareness at various levels of management and now with the board of public corporations that there's a real collective responsibility for the values and ethics of the organization. And frankly, it's combined with, in some cases, more of that regulatory scrutiny that the caller was suggesting is necessary. I think good corporate, good ethical behavior in the organization demands all of these elements. It demands personal responsibility and maybe some personal guilt. It requires some incentives. It requires some regulation, and it requires a hell of a lot of communication by the corporation and by the top management about the values that they want implemented in the organization.
And Beryl, let's try to get you on here. Good morning. Beryl, are you there?
Yes,
hi.
I'm sorry, I'm here. Yes, I would like to discuss the details, if anybody knows more about him wanting to recuse himself. Last night, Andrew Young on the Lehrer NewsHour said that this was a setup. He wanted to recuse himself.
Yeah, Andrew Young said there was nothing wrong here. And Kirk Hansen, what do we know about his offer to recuse himself?
The report released Monday says that that's an overblown claim, that he wanted to recuse himself. Yes, he suggested recusing himself as the solution for the fact that his partner was in the organization. He said, she can stay in the organization, and I'll just recuse myself from decisions regarding her. That was not an adequate answer to the conflict of interest which existed, in part because he was asked by the committee, then you'll put her in a position where she'll not have professional contact with you, and he refused to do that.
Well, we started with Paul Wolfowitz, and we'll conclude with Paul Wolfowitz. A very good and invigorating discussion about ethics and the workplace. I want to extend thanks to Krishna Guha from the Financial Times, who joined us earlier, to Kirk Hansen from the Markula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and Adam Galinsky from the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern, and Susan Springboard, president of Springboard and Associates. Thank you for being here. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.